From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Confederate flag comes off Capitol grounds in South Carolina after an emotional debate. South Carolina State Representative Jenny Horn gave an impassioned speech calling for its removal.
It's about the people of South Carolina who have demanded that this symbol of hate come off of the State House grounds.
Court documents show Bill Cosby admitted giving drugs to women for sex. One of Cosby's accusers, Barbara Bowman, responded.
He can't run anymore. He can't continue to call us liars and call our stories untrue.
The Greek people voted no to new austerity measures in a Sunday referendum. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, speaking through a translator, said that he stood by the decision of his people.
This was a courageous choice by the Greek people, and this is not a decision of breaking off negotiations with Europe.
But it looks like that no on new austerity measures is not the final word. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Yohi Driessen of Foreign Policy, Rachel Smolkin of CNN, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story this week? The Donald versus Hillary on immigration, the flag departing the grounds of the South Carolina State House, the massive computer hack. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Yohi Driessen is with us, Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy. Yohi Driessen, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Hi, Michelle. My pleasure.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Rachel Smolkin. She's Executive Editor for CNN Politics. Rachel Smolkin, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Michelle, Rachel, and Yohi.
Well, it's good to have you all with us. So let's start with Iran. Iran nuclear negotiators have extended self-imposed deadlines twice now. Speaking in Vienna on Thursday, the U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, said that the U.S. would continue to negotiate with Iran on a nuclear agreement, even if the clock strikes midnight. And although the talks will take time, they will not be open-ended.
We are not going to sit at the negotiating table forever. We also recognize that we shouldn't get up and leave simply because the clock strikes midnight. And I emphasize, given that the work here is incredibly technical and that the stakes are very, very high, we will not rush and we will not be rushed.
Yohi, I'm going to ask you to interpret this. How do you read this statement from Secretary of State Kerry?
I read it as they're not going anywhere. And they can say these talks are not open-ended, but they are. They can say that they're not going to extend them indefinitely, but they will. They can say they're not going to get away, stand up from the negotiating table, but they will be at that table until they have a deal. They're invested in this, the Obama administration, full on. This is going to be, if they get it, in the view of the White House, a historic legacy-defining accomplishment. They've invested politically on Capitol Hill. They've invested politically looking ahead to 2016 because Hillary Clinton will be asked about this deal again and again and again, as will the Republicans. So there's just no chance that they're going to walk away from this unless there's some cataclysmic break, which seems hugely unlikely. You know, you've seen the red lines the U.S. has set. You've seen the red lines the Iranians have set. And the red lines have turned out not to be as red as they seem to be. You've got a little smudge here, a little smudge there, and you get closer and closer. It is interesting that today is Al-Quds Day in Iran. This is one of the major events on the Iranian revolutionary calendar. Typically, it's a day when you have American flags burned, Israeli flags burned, Death to America chants in the streets, and you have that again today. So it's a weird dichotomy. You've got very friendly talks in Vienna where you've got, you know, U.S. officials and Iranian officials shaking hands and sort of joking around a little bit. Then in Tehran, you have American flags being burned.
I want to talk a little bit about the timing of this, too, and how important the timing is and this whole question of how long it takes to get to an agreement. But I do want to talk a little bit about the substance of it, Yohi. And, you know, there were reports of a shouting match between Secretary Kerry and the foreign minister, Zarif, during the talks, where it got to the point where it's been reported that an aide had to tell them to pipe down, that people could actually hear them. So what I'm asking you to speculate, but what do you think they were shouting about?
If I had to guess, it's you have this new demand now that the talks are almost theoretically at the end about, from the Iranian side, that a UN embargo on conventional weaponry, so not on nuclear weapons, not on parts for nuclear weapons, but just what we think of as weapons, as guns, tanks, etc., that those be lifted as well, so that the sanctions in place on Iran, not simply for the nuclear program, but also for its conventional military, also be lifted. And that's a relatively new demand. That's something the U.S. has said, and frankly, many of its allies at the U.N. have said, is just not plausible or negotiable. And the other issue, and Secretary Kerry, it reminds me a little bit of the peace process with the Palestinians, where it's always described as, well, we're talking, but we have disagreements on a couple of things, and those couple of things are existential. So here, there are a couple of things they say, well, it's a disagreement, and again, it's kind of an existential part of the deal. The biggest of them is access to Iranian military sites. The U.S., for as long as these talks have gone on, has said those sites have been the place where Iran has hidden work. It's where they've hidden research on ballistic missiles. We have to be able to see those sites. Iran is saying, there's no way on earth we're letting you see those sites. Mm-hmm. And that is probably one of those two things, if not both, would be the thing that would set off Secretary Kerry.
Talk about the timing, if you would. How important is it, or is it important, to get a deal done sooner rather than later? I mean, Bob Corker, the Republican senator of Tennessee, says that the status quo works in the U.S.'s favor. What are your thoughts about that?
Senator Corker is interesting on this because he is a Republican. He's also been a voice of real moderation. He's broken with his party repeatedly. And what he means by that is sanctions remain on Iran as long as these talks go. So we know these sanctions have demolished the Iranian economy. Their currency is worthless. They can't trade. They can't do oil or gas deals. And as long as the talks continue, the vast bulk of those sanctions are in place. So it is true that Iran, day by day, week by week, is losing more money. It's also true that Iran has, day by day, week by week, more influence in Yemen, more influence in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria. So it depends a little bit on how you want to define it. In terms of financial, dollars and cents, the longer this goes, the worse it is for Iran. In terms of impact on U.S. allies around the Middle East, in theory, the longer this goes, the better off for Tehran. And I think that's one of the reasons why you've seen this endless series of extensions. There is one other thing that I was struck by. Secretary Kerry, yesterday referred to deadlines as derisively as artificial deadlines. Well, they aren't artificial. These weren't just sort of dates picked out of nowhere. These were the dates agreed to by the U.S., its partners in Iran. So it's interesting to me that dates that were picked, agreed to, that were something that came distinctly from negotiations are now being just dismissed out of hand as artificial.
Hmm. Rachel, I wanted to ask you about that as well, if you don't mind. I'm interested in your take on this question of the deadlines. And what does that mean? I'm particularly interested in whether that has any effect on the domestic politics of this on the U.S. side. The negotiations have already gone past that congressional deadline set for Thursday. Does this affect the politics of this in the U.S.?
Right. Well, it does seem that the deadlines have become artificial, even if they were not originally intended that way. It does not look like they're going to wrap up today. Most likely will at least stretch into the weekend. We did see a new round of positioning, a little bit of a political diplomatic divide this week as the potential for finger pointing and positioning, among administration officials, administration versus Iran versus Congress all came into sharper focus as the week dragged on, and what looked like maybe would be more progress at this point did not materialize.
But do you feel that this affects the president's ability to sell the deal or not?
If they get a deal, he'll have new ability to sell it. I mean, this is going to be a tough one. It is a legacy issue for him. It's one he's going to push very hard on. And as we've been discussing, there's significant opposition. I mean, it makes it impossible to sell if it's not there, but if there's progress, that will put a new wind at his back as he goes forward to the American people.
Forgive me, I didn't ask that question very well. I guess I was really interested in the whole question of momentum and whether the momentum of these talks is it really comes down to the substance, like what's
it comes down to. Absolutely, that's right. Yes, it's the substance. The momentum isn't there right now, but if the substance emerges, then that could be a game changer politically.
Well, speaking of sort of a question of how kind of momentum and the timing affects the way an issue kind of unfolds. Another big story this week, South Carolina state lawmakers voted to remove the Confederate flag from statehouse grounds. That as we are speaking, this has just occurred in a very elegant and, if I might say, kind of moving ceremony. Governor Nikki Haley signed the bill on Thursday afternoon. This happened very quickly, I think, from historical terms. I mean, if you consider how long people have been talking about this and how quickly this compromise all came together. And I just want to play a short clip from South Carolina's governor speaking after she signed the bill.
While we're still grieving, and the grieving is going to last for a long time. When the emotions start to fade, the history of the actions that took place by everyone in South Carolina to get us to this moment is one that we can all be proud of.
Jacqueline, I'd love to hear from you on this. How do you interpret these events? You know, as I said earlier, the flag has been somewhere on the South Carolina State House grounds since 1961 or 62. I don't recall. During the Civil Rights Movement, it was certainly kind of intended as a political gesture. There was this very hard-fought compromise that led to the flag being moved to the grounds in 2000, where it has sat. A lot of people thought that was as good as it was going to get for the people who wanted the flag removed entirely. And then after the terrible, you know, shooting at that Emmanuel AME Church, there seemed to be new momentum for this. I'm just interested in how you interpret this. Do you think that this speaks to just a unique set of circumstances that led to a particular outcome, or do you think it bespeaks something else?
Well, you know, the lost cause has lost in South Carolina, but it's won in the battle for American memory. It bears repeating. In a 2011 poll, 60% of young Americans said the Civil War was fought over states' rights. In Texas, 5 million students use textbooks that treat slavery as a side issue. Critics charge that state standards require Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln to be treated as moral equivalents. In 2010, a member of the Texas Board of Education made headlines when she said, "There will be those who say the war was over slavery. No, it was over civil states' rights." Shockingly, a plurality of Americans, 48%, agree with her, compared to the 38% who say slavery. Historians emphasize the chief right the Southern states seceded to secure was the right to buy and sell human beings.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. What did you think about Hillary Clinton's first big interview as a presidential candidate this year? And what about Donald Trump? Thoughts about the Greek financial crisis or the New York Stock Exchange glitch? We're with Yohei Driessen, managing editor for News at Foreign Policy, Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Jack, I'm coming back to you. Before the break, you were telling us that we were talking about the Confederate flag and the fact that it has just now been removed in a ceremony from the grounds of the South Carolina Capitol. You're saying the South lost the war, but they won the history books. That the way that the conflict, the way that the underlying issues have been portrayed and that a lot of people accept is not one of the critics. But so I wanted to ask you whether you feel that this moment where the flag has come down and all that led to the flag being removed from these grounds, does that mean something important in the way people are willing to consider this issue now or not?
Well, it depends on what the schools do. I mean, when you have these polls showing 60% of young people think the war was over states' rights, the schools aren't doing their job. They're not teaching the truth as historians believe the documents bear out the truth, and indeed as the testimony of the secessionist convention bear out the truth. The war was about slavery. And if the schools use this flag controversy to trouble the memory of American youth about the war, about slavery, about Jim Crow, segregation, enduring racially patterned social and economic inequality, then there will be a real gain. But if this is just a sort of, this is about the flag and we'll stop talking about the legacy of the Civil War, I don't think that goes far enough.
You know, Rachel, at the same time that South Carolina has voted to remove the Confederate battle flag from the State House grounds, Republicans in Congress were making a push to allow Confederate symbols at national cemeteries. Now, that the amendment that would have done that has since been taken from the floor. But what does that tell us?
This was a stunning contrast this week, and certainly not one that the Republican Party leaders were in the market for. It was a very embarrassing setback for the Republican Party this week. They're trying to make inroads with minority voters, and yet you had House Republican leaders abruptly pulling a spending bill from the floor after this blow-up over the Confederate flag. So they were very much at odds visually and in terms of messaging with Governor Nikki Haley and the work that was being done to pull the flag down in South Carolina.
And now the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has said that he's going to create a bipartisan group to review all matters related to this display of Confederate memorabilia. And I read an interview this morning where the sole African-American member of the – well, no, that's not true. The sole African-American member of the House, Mr. Clyburn, a high-ranking Democrat, said that he doesn't see there's anything to talk about. Where do you think that's going to go? Is that just a way to make it go away?
Well, I think Republican leaders would like this to go away. This is not the issue that they had wanted to talk about. And so John Boehner did step in to try to introduce some calming rhetoric into what turned into a very dramatic day on Capitol Hill.
And as I mentioned, it was a dramatic day in South Carolina. For example, as we are speaking now, just moments ago, South Carolina removed the flag from the Capitol grounds. I just want to play a short clip of the reaction from the crowd as the flag came down. Now let's hear what some of our listeners have to say about this. Let's go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I have two thoughts. Number one, the Republican Party, their base, this is them. They own this now. They absolutely own this. They can't run away from it. They've used it for 50-odd years for their political advantage. Now they own it. Number two, it never ceases to amaze me in our country how black people don't get justice until white people finally say, you know what, we're going to fold under pressure. We need this justice to be done. That's stunningly amazing to me. I've seen.
And can I just ask you this? When you say they own it, can I just ask you this? You're saying when the Republican Party owns this now, what does that mean? I mean, do they own the decision to take it down? I mean, Nikki Haley is a Republican and the South Carolina legislature is Republican dominated.
Well, they own this because you hear people talking about how courageous the congresswoman, the Republican congresswoman, the descendant of Jefferson Davis, how courageous she was on the floor of the House in South Carolina. To me, that's not courageous. That's not courageous at all, because this is something you should have done decades ago. Why are you courageous now in the winds of change? It's sweeping you off your feet. Now you're courageous. So when people like Nikki Haley, when people like Republicans in South Carolina finally coming around to getting this symbol of treason toward the United States and hatred towards black people off state grounds, when they finally come around, it takes nine people to be slaughtered, shot in the face point blank in the church for something like this to come about. This is something that should have been done 50, 60 years ago. As a matter of fact, it should have never even been put up in the first place on state grounds because of civil rights for black people. And it's unfortunate that we sit here and we say, well, what a great thing. No, this is something that should have been done years ago. Right. They don't get any courage points.
All right, Carl, thanks so much for your perspective on this. Thank you for calling. Let's take one more call on this before we move on to another subject. Gabe is with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, what are your thoughts about this?
Hi, Michelle. First of all, you know, that's very eloquent what Carl said. I completely agree with that. I'm also really appreciative of Jack's use of facts and history. And to that, you know, degree, we've heard people talk about supporters of the flag not coming down, how this is a whitewashing of history, that, you know, thinking of the South as all bad and Abraham Lincoln as all good is incorrect. You know, I don't agree with that, but I do believe that the only reason this flag has been able to stay as long as it has is because, you know, the North, the supposed victors in the Civil War, allowed it to happen. You know, there was Reconstruction after the Civil War that ended prematurely because of a tied election. And the compromise was the North got the presidency to end Reconstruction early. We did not finish the job, you know? We allowed this to happen. And, you know, by then, a lot of people in the North were having second thoughts about emancipation. So, you know, it's easy to blame the South. They deserve a ton of blame. But, you know, all America's got to take this on. That being said, today is a great victory for the United States of America. You know, maybe one day we'll actually end the Civil War.
All right, Gabe, thank you so much for your call. Thanks for calling us. Let's move on now to politics and the 2016 election. Hillary Clinton gave her first national interview as a 2016 presidential candidate to CNN this week. Rachel Smolkin, congratulations, I guess, on behalf of your network for scoring this interview. What were some of the big takeaways from that interview from your perspective?
Well, thank you. Breonna Keeler did a wonderful job really bringing out a lot of subjects and a range of discussion from Hillary Clinton, who has not sat down with any journalists for national interviews since joining the race. In fact, she's come under increasing scrutiny and criticism for avoiding the press. And there was an image of some reporters, including one of CNN's, behind a rope line on 4th of July. Weekend that made a lot of fodder for Republicans to call her out on that. Of course, there's nothing like an image to send around and frame for people. But the interview itself was quite interesting. Hillary Clinton talked about the lack of trust that some polls have pointed to that Americans feel for her, and she did not take responsibility for that, but rather turned it to say that she and her husband have long been under attack from Republicans about those issues. She acknowledged the polls, but said, this has been a theme that has been used against me and my husband for many, many years, and that she felt Americans should and do trust her. That was one very interesting piece, the trust issue that they discussed extensively. The other fascinating takeaway from the interview was the discussion about immigration. They spoke about Donald Trump's immigration comments. She said she was disappointed in him and then quickly pivoted to say she was also disappointed that the entire Republican Party had not been quicker to criticize Donald Trump's comments on illegal immigration, to call him out more quickly, and went on to say they're on a spectrum of hostility, which I think is really regrettable in a nation of immigrants like ours. So very much trying to paint all of her 2016 Republican rivals with a broad brush on illegal immigration, and took a particular shot at Jeb Bush in particular, saying that if he once supported a pathway for legal immigration, he no longer does.
Let me play a short clip of that for people who may have missed it. This, as we said, is her first televised interview since, a big interview, big sit-down interview since announcing her presidential candidacy. And she was talking to CNN, and this is just a short clip of what she said. This is what Rachel was talking about here.
They don't want to provide a path to citizenship. They range across a spectrum of being either grudgingly welcome or hostile toward immigrants.
Okay, so Rachel, where is she on immigration?
Well, she's really trying to seize this issue as moving even left on many liberal issues of President Obama. She has not particularly excited the progressive wing of the party. We saw first Elizabeth Warren and now Bernie Sanders kind of carrying the mantle for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. So she is trying to depict herself as a staunch defender of immigrants and paint the Republicans as being opposed. And of course, the lines blur illegal versus legal and some of this rhetoric. Republicans want to position themselves differently with minorities. We were just talking about that in relation to the Confederate flag. And illegal immigration is not the issue that Republicans wanted to be talking about right now. So Donald Trump, whatever his ultimate impact on the race, wherever that ultimately goes, in the early stages, he has forced Republicans onto ground that they didn't want to be on.
Well, you know, to that end, I mean, you mentioned that Hillary Clinton denounced the entire GOP field and then tried to kind of take aim at Jeb Bush, but that Donald Trump is the person who has really elevated this issue and made it a problem, made it difficult for kind of Republicans to find their footing because of the stridency of his remarks. In an NBC interview on Wednesday, he kind of reiterated his comments and also rejected the notion that he is seen unfavorably because of this. He actually said that he's pointing to his history of supporting immigrants through jobs, I guess. I guess in this instance, he's talking about legal immigrants through the work that they do in his many properties. This is what he said.
I have great relationship with the Mexican people. I have many people working for me. You can look at the job in Washington. I have many legal immigrants working for me. Many of them come from Mexico. They love me. I love them. And I'll tell you something. If I get the nomination, I'll win the Latino vote.
You think that's true, Rachel?
Donald Trump has been fascinating on this issue because he's very comfortable being Donald Trump. He's offended many people. We've seen fallout in the corporate world with Macy's and sponsor after sponsor. There have been problems with Univision, a piling on about the comments he's made. And yet he has doubled down or even tripled down on his comments about immigrants. He's very comfortable whether he will appeal to Latino voters after making comments about illegal immigrants as murderers and rapists is very much open to question. Certainly, what it has done without any question or doubt is complicated matters for his Republican rivals who are struggling to figure out, should they immediately denounce him? Should they ignore him? Should they embrace his comments a la Ted Cruz? So it's created this fascinating dynamic early in the 2016 campaign.
Well, one dynamic, Jack, I'm so interested in your perspective on all of this. I mean, Reince Priebus, the RNC chairman, spoke with Donald Trump, and the Washington Post reported that Priebus told him to tone it down. But Donald Trump said on Twitter that it was actually a congratulatory call. So I don't know what you think about this, Jack.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, the best comment of the week was by a Republican operative, Scott Reed, who said, "For years, Trump has wanted to run for president in the worst way, and now he is." The Washington Post went to that building site in Washington where the new Trump Hotel is going up, and they talked to the immigrant laborers who work there. Far from loving Donald Trump, they saw him as a bigot, and they were very afraid of what might happen to them, even for speaking in confidence. And there was some hint, it was hard to figure out, that maybe some of them were off the books, didn't have papers. And it's also come out, of course, that this big decrier of labor in China producing products for us, his clothing line is made in China. More and more, he is an embarrassment, not just to the GOP field, but to the country.
Well, Jack, go back, if you would, to the Hillary Clinton question. You attended a speech given by Hillary Clinton at Dartmouth last week. I'm interested in, what was the tone of her appearance there? And did you see any variance from the way from how she was received there and what she talked about there and how she presented herself during the CNN interview?
Well, she previewed a panoply of new domestic programs. And Republicans will rightly ask, who's going to pay for this nouveau New Deal? But, as Walter Lippmann ruefully reflected, it is war and defense spending, not conservatism, that has stymied liberal reform. World War I derailed progressivism. World War II rang out the New Deal. The Cold War defense buildup in Korea ended Truman's fair deal. Vietnam killed LBJ's great society. Against this pattern, consider Clinton's comments on Iran. In Hanover, she denounced Iranian, quote, aggression. She said Iran was intervening in neighboring countries, but didn't name them. Two of them, Syria and Iraq, have requested Iran's help. This tough talk on Iran resonates with Clinton's inveterate hawkishness, her vote for the Iraq war, her support for escalation in Afghanistan, for bombing Libya and Syria, arming the Syrian rebels. History suggests that you can pursue an interventionist foreign policy, or you can expand the welfare state, but that you can't do both.
Before we let you go on this segment, before we take a short break, I did want to ask briefly, Jack, what do you think that Secretary Clinton needed to accomplish with these media appearances, and do you think she succeeded?
Well, I think she's, her people have already said they're worried about Bernie Sanders, and she's been following a kind of, quiet approach, not doing major rallies and so on, and that this fencing off, literally, of the media isn't paying off, and that they have to change their strategy and make her more put her on television. Look what it's done for Donald Trump.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, another Women's World Cup title for the U.S. That makes three, the same number of goals U.S. midfielder Carly Lloyd scored in the final against Japan.
Lloyd with Morgan streaking. She's chipping the goalkeeper! Off the post and in! Hat-trick for Lloyd!
Computer glitches struck United Airlines and the New York Stock Exchange. CNBC reported trading came to a halt.
Welcome back. While we were in commercial break, traders here at the NYSE just said, whoa.
Pope Francis, the first pontiff from South America, returned to his home continent for a three-country tour. Worshippers in Quito, Ecuador screamed as the Pope-mobile passed by. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the news about the United Airlines and the New York Stock Exchange glitches? And what about the news about Bill Cosby? We're with Yohi Driessen, Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy, Rachel Smolkin, Executive Editor at CNN Politics, and Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Yohi, I just want to spend a little bit of time before we move on about the story that really captured a lot of our attention at the beginning of the week, which is the Greek financial crisis. It does appear that after some very dire warnings at the beginning of the week about this is really impending disaster, that the sides, the negotiators, seem to be moving forward. It seems as though that there's some movement there. Want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing some of the imagery that came out this week before we had the movement that you, I think, rightly flagged. You had long lines of people trying to get $60, roughly, €60, $67 out of ATMs. You now have ATMs all over the country that are empty of cash. You have hospitals running out of supplies. You have newspapers, literally Greek newspapers, running out of paper on which to print the bad news that they're covering. So you've had not just an impending disaster, you've had an actual disaster. I mean, to think that this is a European country, a member of NATO, it's really already sort of mind-boggling. But you're right. You are seeing finally a little bit of sunlight. Last week, you had the Greek prime minister say, we will never accept this deal. We can never accept these terms, these austerity measures, which call for raising taxes, further cutting back on welfare benefits. These are things we can never accept. I'm going to go to my people. My people will back me. They'll vote no to accept this. He went to his people. His people voted no. Flash forward a day, and he said, well, actually, those things, we can't accept them. You know, it turns out that when you're desperate enough, as he is, the things you said you would never do are things you actually find yourselves willing to do. So the question in some ways is Europe, in particular Germany, has been so angry and so impatient and for so long has felt about the Greeks, your country's history is hanging in the balance, its future is hanging in the balance. We keep waiting for you to be serious about it. You haven't been. Now that Greece is being serious, there's a bit of a question of, is it too late? I mean, when you have so much distrust, so much anger, actual anger, there have been shouting matches repeatedly built up between Germany and France, primarily on the one side, Greece on the other. Can you actually bridge that, even though you now have concessions that he had explicitly said he would not make even 3 days ago?
Obviously something we're going to all have to keep our eyes on. But, Jack, I wanted to ask you about going back to, once again, our friend Donald Trump, who suggested that Greece is a cautionary tale for the United States. What do you make of that?
Well, Donald Trump is right. Three words I'm unlikely to repeat. He's right, but he's not right that U.S. debt may cause a debt crisis a la Greece. That's because, how to put this, the U.S. is not Greece. For the 5 years of this Greek debt drama, conservatives have warned that our debt, $18 trillion, would spike interest rates, spark inflation, stampede foreign investors from the dollar. None of this has happened. None of it shows a tendency to happen. Trump is right. Greece is a cautionary tale, but not the one he thinks. Greece shows what happens when a government sharply cuts spending while following an inflation-obsessed monetary policy. In Greece's case, the one forced on it by Germany. As Paul Krugman and Dan Dresner have both argued, spending cuts, slightly offset by tax cuts, tilted to the rich and tight money, are GOP policy prescriptions. They sped Greece's descent into an economic basket case. That is the cautionary tale for the U.S.
But he's not the only Republican person of stature who thinks this, correct, who has that philosophy. I think that Paul Ryan also has that point of view, or had that point of view, or has expressed that. Am I right about that?
Oh, yes. So. This has been a constant theme of conservative alarm for, as I say, this whole crisis, from Alan Greenspan to Paul Ryan. The idea is we have to cut our budget now sharply, especially social spending. That will inflict pain, but it will be better than the pain we'll have to inflict on ourselves in the future. So you sort of, it's like preemptive pain. Only the people who are going to suffer, of course, are those who depend on, I don't know, Medicare, Social Security, all the rest of the things the government does. So yes, Trump is right in line with these people who point to Greece as a cautionary tale for the United States. You know, the United States has the world's largest economy. Greece, the economy of Dallas-Fort Worth. There's no comparison.
Well, okay, let's move on to that computer glitch that got a lot of our attention this week. There was a big scare when glitches took down the New York Stock Exchange for more than 3 hours, and United Airlines flights were grounded, and the Wall Street Journal's website crashed. Testifying Wednesday before the Senate Intelligence Committee, FBI Director James Comey said he doesn't believe that there was a cyber threat behind these technical issues at either the Stock Exchange or the Wall Street Journal website. This is what he said.
We do not see any indication of a cyber breach or cyber attack. I actually think the Wall Street Journal piece is connected to people flooding their website in response to the New York Stock Exchange.
But, you know, hey, let's be honest. I mean, isn't that where most of our minds went? I mean, didn't at least people think, yeah, this is not, you know, technical.
Yeah, I think that's immediately where people's minds went. And frankly, not necessarily incorrectly. I mean, the government doesn't have a great track record of being upfront about either the existence of a hack or the size of the hack. This was also a week where OPM, the obscure bureaucracy here in Washington that handles the personal information and payroll of every federal employee in the country, including my wife, so this one hits a little bit home, close to home, admitted that a hack that was initially thought to affect 1 million people, then 4 million people, may now have affected 25 million people. And this wasn't just a hack that they're discovering about in the last couple of days, and now they're saying, well, based on what we know 2 days later, we now know this. This was a hack that took place many months ago. So months ago, this thing happened. It wasn't disclosed. Then it was disclosed, and it wasn't remotely in the universe of how big it actually was. So people, I think, are right to wonder about a hack. You know, when people think about what a hack could do, they worry about what could it do to the American financial system? What could it do to the American transportation system? Both those systems were hit hard the same day.
Well, talk about this. Stay on this whole question of this hack of the Office of Personnel Management that compromised, as you said, like more than 20 million people's, you know, private information. You know, there were huge headlines when Sony Pictures was hacked and this happened. It just, I mean, 20 million people it's a huge number of people whose information has potentially been compromised. I mean, what are they going to do about this?
Now, Michelle, I think you're exactly right. I mean, with Sony, you had these kind of fun emails that peeled back the curtain a bit on Hollywood. So for gossip sites, it was just endless. It was like catnip. Nobody has a lot of sympathy, generally, for federal bureaucrats. Again, with apologies to my wife, these are not people that the public generally thinks, boy, I really feel bad that they're suffering. They're just not people who engender much sympathy. But the kind of information that's taken here, names, Social Security numbers, bank account numbers for money and that's being payrolled, people who submitted, in some cases, very sensitive information for security clearances. So people who admitted to affairs, to drug use, to being alcoholics, to having all kinds of other personal issues, all of that is now in the hands of someone. Most people on the planet, I think, would say those someone are the people of China. So it isn't simply a hack of emails. It isn't even simply a hack of Social Security numbers. It's in many ways the literally most intimate parts of people's lives by the millions. It's extraordinary.
What does this bespeak, though, Yohi? Does this bespeak the fact that for whatever reason, the technological infrastructure of the United States government has not kept pace with the demands of the modern world? Is this a infrastructure problem or is this a leadership problem? You know, I note that the members of Congress, frankly, from both parties, have called upon the head of the Office of Personnel Management to resign. She says she won't. But is this a system problem? Is this a hardware problem, if you will, or is this a leadership problem in not doing things that need to be done just to function properly in the modern world?
Not to be glib, but perhaps we can go with option D, that it's all of the above. I mean, this is, I think part of what you're seeing here is that the Pentagon, the intelligence community, they know that China is trying to hack them. The estimates are that there are millions of attempts every day to hack the Pentagon and its systems, literally millions. So they have built up as best they can and spent gigantic amounts of money to build cyber defenses. I think what you saw here with the Office of Personnel Management, this is not necessarily a site that you would have thought would be a top target for China. It's federal bureaucrats. And I think what you're seeing is that the aggressiveness and the scope of what a country like China is trying to get from the U.S. government is much bigger than we think, which also means that parts of the U.S. government that don't get a lot of attention but are actually hugely important, which probably have not invested a lot in cyber defense, USDA, so the FDA, excuse me, places that look at drugs, that look at food safety, I can guarantee you they do not spend even a fraction of what the Pentagon spends. I can also guarantee you that China is trying to hack them.
Jack, how does this story strike you?
Well, you know, we need to have something like mutually assured destruction vis-a-vis China on cyber warfare. I mean, it's just clear this has to be deterred, either deterred by striking at China or through some sort of agreement. But it can't go on. These 25 million people whose information has been hacked, intimate information, as Joey says, we're going to be hearing from them as China or whoever it is puts the squeeze on some of them and says, you know, we want you to do this or that, or we'll make public what we know. That is going to create a tremendous row. And people are going to insist that we either make this the subject of diplomacy with China or retaliation.
Rachel, is this a big story for CNN viewers, or this is something that they're very interested in?
Well, this is a huge story given the scope of the breach. I mean, 21.5 million people affected, Social Security numbers stolen. It's absolutely a huge story. And as often as always in Washington, when a problem occurs, the next round is the blame game. So we are very much seeing that turn, as you mentioned, to Catherine Archuleta, the woman at the head of the organization of the OPM, and we saw House Speaker John Boehner become the latest lawmaker to call for her to step down. We're now seeing bipartisan calls, the same sort of gathering forces against her that may be difficult for her ultimately to hold out against. It's beginning to take on the flavor of a heck of a job brownie moment. Mm.
Speaking of a big story that CNN has devoted a lot of attention to, new information about this ongoing saga involving the comedian and I would say one time, you know, icon Bill Cosby. New information that a deposition that was taken years ago was unsealed under the order of a judge. What have we found out this week that we didn't know before, Rachel?
That's right. It's a stunning disclosure this week that Bill Cosby has admitted to getting prescription Quaaludes to give to women he wanted to have sex with. This is according to newly released documents. These date back to 2005, and they stem from a civil lawsuit. In most of these cases, the accusations by the women, the statute of limitations has expired. Too much time has elapsed for any kind of criminal prosecution, although there is one potential case that is being looked into in Los Angeles that may develop into something more. We're all watching to see what happens next. But a shocking disclosure, and many of the women who have accused him have spoken with CNN, either they or their attorneys, and said that they feel that their voices are finally being heard and that they see now that perhaps there will be a chance for justice to be done after feeling for so many years that nobody would hear them, nobody would believe them.
A couple of things to note. The actor Omar Sharif has died at the age of 83. He earned an Oscar nomination for his role in Lawrence of Arabia. And of course, I think many people think of him in, of course, Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago. He was born in Egypt. He won 2 Golden Globe Awards and an Oscar nomination for his role as Sheriff Ali in Lawrence of Arabia. And he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and he suffered a heart attack this afternoon in a hospital in Cairo. So certainly our thoughts go out to his family. But on a happier note, I want to spend our last couple of minutes talking about Sunday's Women's World Cup final between the U.S. and Japan. It had 26.7 million U.S. viewers, the most watched soccer game in U.S. history. You know, Yohei, I'm going to go to you on this. Soccer is the most popular sport in the world. I think that's, I'm on firm ground in this. It's the most popular youth sport in America, probably because unlike American football, which is extremely popular, it's the most watched sport in the country. But in terms of the sport that kids actually play, organized sport, both boys and girls can play. Now, we keep saying, when is soccer going to take off? When is soccer going to take off? Has it taken off, Yohei?
I think so. I mean, you know, we often, perhaps unfairly, think that men's sports is by definition going to be more popular than women's sports. In Washington, in Chicago, where my mom lives, she was sending me photos. You had viewing parties in parks and here in Washington, in some of the circles of Washington, large screens set up, thousands of people sitting outside in the heat to watch these games on these giant screens with other fans. So I think it's arrived in terms of how many kids play. I think it's arrived in terms of how many colleges have programs to take it very seriously. The Major League Soccer, they're building a new stadium in Washington. They found a business model that works. And you have tens of millions of people watching on TV and large numbers who want to sit out in the heat with other fans and watch it with their friends. It's incredible.
Sit out in the heat. Yohei, I take it that you are not among them. Do I have that right? You're not sitting out in the heat. Do I have it right?
Very good call.
Jack, what about you? Has soccer taken off? Were you glued to your tube watching the women's final?
I certainly was, and with a group of people, and we were cheering like rabid nationalists. But really, we weren't just cheering for the country. We were cheering for these young women and for American law, Title IX, which has made such a huge difference in American life.
All right, we have to leave it there for now. Jack Beattie is On Point News analyst. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Yohei Driessen is Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy. Yohei, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
And Rachel Smolkin is Executive Editor for CNN Politics. Rachel, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much to you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, the Obama administration just announced rules to address segregation almost 50 years after the Fair Housing Act, but critics are calling it social engineering. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.